Welcome back to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Mike Lewis filling in for Dave Ross. On Tuesdays, we call up Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and New York Times investigative reporter David Ferenthold. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us.
Morning. I'm glad to be here.
So we've got there's so many things to talk about, but let's start off with the biggest story in the country, at least as it relates to courts. The former president sat in a crowded courtroom yesterday while potential jurors assembled. Do we know anything about the jurors that were dismissed during yesterday's process?
Not much. In the beginning stages, I mean, this is something they do at every trial, but there's a much higher number of people who raise their hands at a trial like this. They say, if you just think you can't be impartial in this trial, raise your hand. You know, and so I think like 50 people the first day out of a class of 96 raised their hands and said, look, I can't be impartial. You know, which you might imagine. Trump is somebody that very few people, I think, in this country, especially in New York, where they know him so well and have known him for so long, would say like, oh, I'm a blank slate on Donald Trump. You know, I can be completely impartial about him. So I'm not that surprised. But we don't know whether they were impartial because they couldn't be impartial because they hate him or couldn't be impartial because they love him.
Right. And so who are the most important figures that we expect to sort of get on display here in court, either from testimony or just from assessment of what happened in the trial, or rather what happened in the case prior to this? I mean, who do we expect to sort of surface from a witness standpoint?
Well, I think there's three big witnesses that they're going to hear from. One is Michael Cohen, Trump's old fixer, his lawyer, who was the one who arranged this payment to keep the silence of Stormy Daniels. Number two is this guy named David Pecker, who was the head of the National Enquirer. I forget the name of the company, but basically head of the National Enquirer, who was basically he was the one who arranged this. Theoretically, he was paying Stormy Daniels to gain the rights to her story, but everybody knew that he was not going to ever publish her story. So that would mean that the story would be killed.
Right.
And then Stormy Daniels herself, talking about her experience with Trump and then, you know, how she was paid off to stay silent.
What was the former president's demeanor in court?
Well, for the beginning, apparently he was sleeping a lot of the time. He seemed to be, people who were in the courtroom said that in the beginning, he seemed to be like nodding off, his mouth would sort of hang open, like he was falling asleep in court. Later in the day, when the judge was, you know, addressing the jurors and saying that he would be impartial and, you know, that this case would be done fairly, Trump sort of scoffed and laughed at the judge.
And how long do we expect juror selection to last? Is this going to be a relatively brief process, or is this going to extend for a while?
The prediction I read was 2 weeks. I mean, I think that the jury selection may last almost as long as the trial.
Right. Let's switch over then, although this is somewhat dovetails with it. The most recent Times Siena poll shows a relatively close race between current president and the former president, a single percentage point separating the two. What does it say about the presidential race? And then also, what does it say about who do you think out there remains undecided?
Well, I think it is. To your first question, what does it say about the race? It says that we're still early in this race, and the people who are going to make the decision, the people who are going to decide, and I think that's both people who are just not that politically engaged and people who hate both Trump and Biden, but those people are still up for grabs. So to your second point, you know, who hasn't made up their minds? I think it's hard for me to sort of wrap my mind around this since I live in the Washington bubble every day. But there's a lot of people out there for whom, you know, politics is secondary, even in an age like now where there's so much drama in politics. And I think those people are going to, you know, make up their minds as we get closer to the election. And it's going to have to do with the economy, how they feel about Joe Biden's economy. And also, I think, with their perceptions of Trump. You know, do they remember sort of the rosy economy of Trump, or do they, you know, remember January 6th, you know, the lying, the dysfunction? You know, what side of the Trump presidency they remember?
Well, what would you, if you had to weigh the economy versus the criminal trial, the multiple criminal trials that the former president is facing, which of those two would you say are more likely to tilt the independent or the still undecided voters one way or the other?
I mean, I feel like the answer always has to be the economy. You know, for so many people, the question of, you know, how are you doing? How the optimism you feel about the economy? That's what drives their election, their choice, even though obviously presidents, you know, there's a lot of factors beyond the president that affect that. I feel like that's the grounding for so many people's choices. So I think it'll be in this case as well.
The Supreme Court is hearing arguments today in a case that could potentially change some of the other charges against former president. This is regarding January 6th. Can you explain to us a little bit about what's going on here?
Yeah, this is about a charge that was, January 6th, many of the rioters who broke into the building were charged with assaulting police officers or breaking and entering. But in some cases, they didn't assault a police officer. They didn't break and enter. They just came in because other people had already done those things. And some of those folks were charged with a crime that was basically created after Enron.
And
the crime was to sort of disrupt official proceedings. It was sort of meant to stop people from destroying evidence in white-collar cases, but it was written vaguely enough that the Justice Department charged people with basically, you know, you were there to disrupt the official proceeding of the certification of the 2020 election results. And so hundreds of people have gotten charged with that, were convicted of that. Trump is two of the four charges against Trump in the January 6th case that's pending against him are related to this. And basically the lawyers for those folks have said, no, you know, this charge was misused. This is about, you know, somebody shredding documents somewhere. It doesn't apply to disrupting a proceeding of Congress. We'll see what the Supreme Court says. I don't know. I haven't thought enough about the legal implications to know what the most likely outcome is, but we'll see what the Supreme Court says today.
Well, and the Supreme Court also is looking at the sort of what is the scope of presidential immunity during this whole process, right? I mean, this is going to be regular return visits to the Supreme Court, it sounds like, for the next few months.
Oh, yeah. Trump has already set up, I think it's late next month, that he's supposed to go in his case of the presidential immunity, which he's saying, you know, basically, if you're president, you can do whatever you want. You know, there's no law that applies to the president, you know, criminal law. Presidents can be impeached, but they can't be, you know, charged with crimes even after they leave the presidency. So he's made that argument. A bunch of judges have shut it down, and a lot of people expected the Supreme Court would just not even take up the case. But they did. They're going to hear arguments in it. So even if they come down and say Trump's wrong, that there is no presidential immunity, that means that it's delayed significantly, that January 6th case, and means that it may not even happen until after the election.
All right. Well, then, final thing, what is the latest on the battle in Congress regarding aid to Ukraine? It looks like the House and the Senate are not in complete alignment on what should happen next.
Well, the underlying factor here is Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House's weakness. And he has said he wants to do both Israel aid and Ukraine aid to get both of those passed. But there's a lot of people in the Republican caucus who don't want Ukraine aid. And some Democrats who don't want Israel aid. And remember, Johnson, I think, has like a two-vote margin, so he can't really lose anybody. So I think the most likely outcome is that the House will pass the bill that the Senate already passed, which was the bill that combines aid to Israel and aid to Ukraine, and maybe add a little bit some other sort of conservative, you know, things to please the conservatives. That seems to be the glide path it's on, but he has very little margin and very little self-confidence, and he's only got this week to do it because the House is on recess again next week.
So we're facing a pretty tight deadline then.
There is, and maybe that will motivate. Deadlines are really the only thing that motivates them, so maybe that will motivate them.
Excellent point. David Farenthold with the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It is time for choke points. We've all seen 405 expanding between Bellevue and Redmond, but construction to widen the freeway north of Bothell is now underway as well.
Yeah, and the state's widening both directions, Mike, of 405 from about 160th at the north end of Kirkland to Highway 527 in Canyon Park. The new lane in each direction will be added to the existing one-lane express toll lane system. Now, this is the spot where my kazoo got its start because the tolls could not keep up with the amount of cars on that stretch of 405. There's just not enough room, and the volume is pretty thick. And so the toll lane continues to hit the $15 max nearly every day there because it's so crowded. So they're trying to fix that and give a little bit more capacity so the express lanes don't bog down as often. So that's what we've got going on there. And, you know, this expansion also will come with a new 405-522 interchange to help manage the flow there. I talked to Washington Department of Transportation's Craig Smiley saying that, you know, there isn't a lot of room to make changes there.
That interchange at 522 has a lot of constraint. There's a lot of flyover bridges and different things going on there. You got the Sammamish Slough. So it's really a challenge to get additional capacity through there.
So, Chris, does that $15 max toll, has that had any effect on behavior other than maybe, you know, celebration in the toll collector's booth?
No, and only primarily in this spot, right? It really only hits that 15 in that constrained spot where there's one less lane. Once you get down to 160th and it opens up into a, you know, bigger area, the toll rates there usually don't hit 15 very often. So it's just in that one spot on 405.
Where the meter gets pegged.
Correct.
Right.
So that's what they're trying to do. And in fact, that's the one reason that section basically drags down all the metrics for everything else. Like, if you remember at the beginning of this whole discussion, it was supposed to make it 45 miles an hour, 80% of the time. And then there was that whole argument of, well, is it supposed to meet both of those benchmarks or just one? The legislature made it just one. So, and it was all because of that one section was dragging everything else down. And so they're trying to address that now. And so that by doing that, they're adding this extra lane there to hopefully kind of relieve that. Maybe we won't hit the 15 so often. So what's happening at the 522 and 405 interchange? A lot of people have noticed a bunch of trees are being removed along the east side of the freeway because they're moving a lot of the ramps between 522 and 405. To kind of ease congestion.
So adding additional capacity from that northbound to eastbound ramp, that's been a challenge for a long time. So that will have some additional capacity there and hopefully help out with that movement.
I'll be posting some pictures and designs at mynorthwest.com a little bit later on this morning. I got to my choke point a little late today. So I was working on the protest. Yeah, last night a little. Well, those will be up there soon. They're also going to do some culvert work there. As you know, there's a bunch of that obviously continuing. So they're going to be working on that. Also on bus runs, but transit. They're going to build a couple of stations along the line there, too. So now to make all this happen, though, we're going to have a bunch of road and ramp closures during this project. The first one was last weekend, and there's going to be another one this weekend on Highway 522. WashDOT's Lauren Penning says all eastbound lanes of 522 near 405 are going to have to be closed this weekend as they create work zones.
The closure this weekend, it'll be 10 p.m. on Friday, April 19th to 4 a.m., Monday, April 22nd, we'll have all lanes of eastbound State Route 522 closed and one lane of westbound right by the I-405 interchange there.
For drivers heading east out of, say, downtown Bothell who want to continue to go over into Woodinville, there's going to be a little bit of a detour during this closure.
Drivers heading eastbound will be detoured off onto southbound 405, take that 160th, Northeast 160th Street exit, can kind of cross over the freeway and then get on North 405 and continue at the 522 interchange there going eastbound.
Well, don't expect too much relief over the short term. This is going to be a very long process, long project. It's hard. They've got, working over the top of Sammamish Slough. They've got a bunch of different things in the way, and there's really just a constrained space there. This is an $834 million expansion project, not set to finish until 2028. So no relief for a while, but they're working on it. They're working on it. So it's, and I think this will definitely make a difference in the toll rate specifically when it gets going.
Do you, and with the expansion there, is there also, it seems like there's always a concern that the growth in that area, which has been, somewhat significant, that will just catch right up to...
It probably will. Yeah, I live kind of up in that north of that area, and that part of North King and South Snohomish continues to be one of the largest growing. They're throwing houses in there all over the place. North of Woodinville, there is no real gaps anymore between you reach up to there, up to the south east end of Mill Creek, all the way up almost to, Glacier Peak High School as you work your way down into Highway 9 into Snohomish. So we'll see where it goes. Again, it's just, when you get right down to it, Mike, it's the topography here. We're just kind of constrained by so many different kinds of things and the environmental issues that they have to deal with there. And there really isn't a lot of room to do stuff. If they were going to redo that whole interchange, take it all the way down, take the pilings out and redo it in a way that would be, it would be astronomical in terms of the price.
Right.
They're doing what they can for, I know, $834 sounds like a lot. That's a lot of millions of dollars. But if they were to knock this thing down and start over, it would be so cost prohibitive. But
right.
They're trying something. So I, wish them the best. But yeah, construction underway.
Welcome back to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Colleen O'Brien. If you're looking for a compelling story, look no further than our sister station in Salt Lake City. KSL has produced season 2 of The Letter, and this one is a story of murder, trauma, and forgiveness. Here's a short summary. On a winter morning, 1982, two young fathers were found shot to death in a van outside an iconic restaurant in the Utah mountains. The killer soon confessed, but his story and why he chose violence would create more pain, conflict, and questions for the families.
Not long after Jordan left home the morning he died, Deanne Rasmussen woke her children for the day.
Jordan told me that he would call me. I called down to his office. They said, no, Jordan hasn't come in yet.
But mom duties beckoned.
And shortly after 11:30, my doorbell rang. So I got up, opened the front door, and I just knew. They said, we have something terrible to tell you.
from KSL Podcast Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect. It's out now. We have host of this season, Amy Donaldson, joining us now. Amy, wow, what a setup, number one. Number two, tell us how this story came to you.
That's actually an interesting story. So a prosecutor that I covered crime and corrections for about 8 years for the newspaper here in Salt Lake. And then I switched to sports in 2000 and I was doing my sports thing and had come back to work on podcasts with KSL Podcasts and made the first season of The Letter, which we thought was going to be the only season of The Letter. It's such a unique story. There's only one letter, right? So I thought, this is a one and done. I was actually moving on to another podcast project. When I got this call from this prosecutor I hadn't talked to in like 25 years. And he said, I'm listening to your podcast and I know a similar story. I don't know if you have anything else planned, but you know, what do you think? And so we sort of just started looking into it almost out of like, you know, I have a lot of professional respect for this gentleman. And we found out that not only was there another letter, a totally different letter, right? A different way it happened. It's just so different, but also sort of the same struggle. Like, what do you do and how do you rebuild your life when something terrible happens to you?
In the summary of this, there's a lot of talk of forgiveness and, mm-hmm. and can you forgive? That seems to be a major theme of this, despite the topic being murder.
That was another thing. Like, I didn't want to have the same conversations that we'd already had in season one, in part because it was such a unique season. It didn't feel, some of it didn't feel like a thing that anyone could have access to. And what I discovered in just in the first months of researching this story was that there are so many other complexities to this idea of forgiveness and of rebuilding and why people forgive, who deserves it, do you have to earn it, you know, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And also, I think one of the driving reasons I decided to do this was that I wondered what it would do. Like, we know trauma can be inherited through generations of a family. And obviously having someone in your family murdered creates, an impact that keeps, you know, rippling through your family for generations. I wondered if forgiveness was something that people could also impact, you know, pass on or take as a gift in their family. So, yeah, it was really interesting.
Yeah, I'll say. Yeah, forgiveness and all of that and the inheriting forgiveness. I hadn't considered that before. Let's set this up a little bit more because, the bodies were found in a car outside of a restaurant. And the way that came to be also adds a layer of mystery. Let's listen to that.
An overnight snowstorm had transformed the Salt Lake Valley into a winter wonderland. Jordan turned onto Mill Creek Canyon Road and almost immediately he pulled over. He wasn't sure his car could make the 3-mile drive to Log Haven in these conditions. Then he saw a familiar Jeep idling on the other side of the road. He watched as the driver swung around and pulled off the road in front of him. Jordan got out and talked to the man, who threw a half-smoked cigarette out the window as they exchanged a few words. Then Jordan walked around to the passenger side, opened the door, and climbed in. Maybe he was in a hurry and just didn't notice the bullet holes that marred the side of the Jeep. One on the hood and one just in back of the front tire. Jordan was prepared for a tense conversation, but he had no way of knowing that he was driving to his death.
Goodness, that gives me goosebumps. Yeah, just the mystery surrounding this. Now, in the beginning, I remember the summary saying two young fathers were found shot to death in a van. What does this have to do with that?
One of the, I guess, the difficulties in telling a narrative style podcast when you're talking about sort of a news event is that, you know, a lot of the facts are already known. And so for me, the question was, how best could you follow these people and their journeys? There's two families that are impacted by murder. And I guess there would be a third if you count the family of the killer. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted you to be able to follow them independently. And so the first episode really is following Jordan Rasmussen, the 32-year-old who's found in that van. And at the end, we're going to pivot and you'll learn about the second gentleman. He's a 24-year-old delivery driver and you'll learn about him in episode 2.
Oh my goodness. This is the mystery and thickens. There's so many layers. How long did you spend researching this? How long did it take to put this podcast together?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm still going down information rabbit holes, but we had less time because we, you know, on the first season, I was sort of working on that on my own at my own pace for a couple of years before I committed to doing it for KSL Podcasts. But right away, everyone was interested in, is there a way to do, to have these same kinds of conversations that were really embraced by our audience? They really loved discussing grief and trauma and that, you know, seems sort of strange, right? But like, I think people were craving this connection and just a real honest to goodness, in-depth discussion about these things. And so I spent about a year and a half, the first 9 months by myself, because my producer was working on her own project, just doing the research and doing the interviews. And then we've had an amazing team, but it's been a lot more complicated, I will say, and a lot more painful than the first season.
What do you mean by painful?
It's just, you know, a lot of things to grapple with that were not issues in the first season. And some of that is what happens in generational forgiveness. Like, if I forgive somebody, is it incumbent on my children to forgive that person? Or do they struggle with that same issue that I tried to save them from, right? Just the things like that. And then also this idea of, does a person have to be sorry? I think in season one, it didn't feel easy, but it felt like, oh, he was clearly sorry. Whether or not you bought it or forgave him, I totally understood all of the options, right? But in this season, there's a real question as to, as my mother would say, whether or not you deserve it. And then I started wondering, like, do you have to deserve forgiveness? And if it's not, if forgiveness is not available to the worst people, is it really available to anyone?
This is from KSL Podcasts, our sister station down in Salt Lake City. It's season two of The Letter, Ripple Effect with Amy Donaldson. It is out now where you can find podcasts. A labor of love, clearly. Can't wait to listen, Amy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your daily dose of kindness now brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. CBS's David Begno has the story of an unlikely friendship at a Massachusetts elementary school, proving that words are not always necessary to form a special connection.
9-year-old Elif loves being at school. But for a long time, her dad was worried about whether she'd be okay after he dropped her off. You see, Elif has a severe developmental delay.
Me read again?
Me read again?
And doesn't talk much on her own. Then one day, to her dad's relief, and to Elif's joy, she made a very good friend. Not with a student, not with a teacher, but with someone very special. The school's guardian. And now Elif's too. Meet police officer Ryan Foley.
I cried, I'll be honest with you, because I know that someone is watching her. She's safe.
Yeah. What made you cry?
Because I see that she's trusting someone, except her father or her mother or her aunts or uncles.
On days when Officer Foley watches over recess, Elif keeps an eye out for him. She heads for the doors, crosses the parking lot without saying a word, and makes a beeline for Foley. He's always standing in the same place, waiting for her to take his hand and take him with her.
So she has a set route that she does. There's certain bricks that she steps on, certain points on the curb that she likes to hit. But mostly it's like zone out time. It's just a peaceful 30-minute walk.
Even though there are no words exchanged between the two of you, do you feel some kind of communication with her?
A connection, yeah. I think she senses that I'm also pretty quiet too, and you know, I think that might play into her being more comfortable, that I'm not pressuring her to do anything. It's just walk. She knows I'm all on for the walk, I guess.
Yeah.
She's the boss.
This has been going on for how long now?
About a year and a half.
Day after day.
There was one day that I didn't go out there, and her teacher, Erin, was like, oh, she wasn't very happy. She was looking for you. she was asking for you, and then she went and sat on the bench and wouldn't do anything.
Though Elif doesn't speak the way most kids do, her body language says so much. If she wants you to go away, she'll let you know. Come with me is pretty clear, too.
That is David Begno reporting. We'll be right back.
Now joining us from the G and Ursula Show, which you can hear from 9 to noon right here on Cairo Radio, is my friend G. Scott. G, last night was the arguably the biggest night in WNBA history of the league.
Ever. It was pandemonium, and I don't know what the pause was, because maybe the pause was because, but if you can look at my text messages, it is all about the draft with my boys. Where everybody, we're sitting there, my homies on the text. Do you know how many times in the history of text messages where the fellas was sitting around at their own homes watching the WNBA draft and we were talking about it round and round, just pick by pick by pick, where this is going to go, buying tickets to the game, to the Storm game, May 22nd, where the Indiana Fever is going to be coming to town, planning out when the Aces are coming to town. I mean, Colleen, you got that smirk on your face and that look. What is that look on your face? Tell
me. I do. Only
what is
because
that?
Right now, all I'm thinking of is the conversation we were all having maybe a year ago when the conversation was, well, nobody's interested in women's sports because they don't dunk. Nobody watches women's sports. And now suddenly men are text messaging about the WNBA draft and it's legitimate. Like, for me, I still feel extra special bitter about the whole transition and that I'm happy for the bandwagon. Come on in. The women love you. Mm-hmm. But it still just makes me feel a little weird that the transition has happened so quickly and that there's still no apology.
So what do you want? Okay. If there were an apology, what would you want the apology to be, and what would you want the apology to be specifically about?
I think that's up to the basketball players, but for me, I want the apology to be from the network execs. I want it to be from the other male allies out there who believed in those mantras, the they don't dunk, the nobody watches, and instead going, we were wrong. We were absolutely wrong. We're sorry about this, and now we're ready to give women their due.
Well, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to, one quick question, G. I mean, I turned to my favorite sports publication on the after the WNBA draft, Vogue, and I found that Vogue, like when Vogue is weighing in on the red carpet of the WNBA draft, I mean, I feel like that's, we're sort of at, definitely at a sea change. A lot of this has to do with, I think, to Colleen's point about the broadcasters. They essentially, a few years ago in the NCAA women's tournament, got shamed into, like, why do you keep saying it's not popular enough when you put it in such lousy broadcast times? And as soon as they moved it, and as soon as the WNBA got better slots, bang. Uh-huh. Everything starts. I mean,
because as you said, G, there's always been stars. It's right. About getting those stars in front of everybody's eyes.
Fair.
I don't want to turn this so negative. Asked me about my smirk, and that was it.
No,
it was just like, this still feels empty that we haven't quite given them their due.
Fair. An apology is due. But the same apology happened probably in 1980, right? Because in the NBA, previous to 1980, games were on tape delay.
Yes, that's true.
People were watching games. So the execs then did not believe in the product. The fans, nobody was caring and watching the NBA until the two, Magic Johnson and Larry Bird.
Exactly.
When those two came to the league, the network's exec says, oh, we're going to now start playing the games. So I would assume that they needed an apology then as well. So the reason we are here today, and this is not rocket science. We are here today because lightning was captured in a bottle with Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese last year. So you had those two giants going at it, and you have names. We know their names. So it comes into this year. We were all kind of sitting back and paying attention, and oh boy, Caitlin Clark did not disappoint.
Dressed in Prada.
She was incredible. And then we have been talking about it the entire time. And then last night, April 15th, April 15th, tax day, but we're sitting there watching it, and it was like I'd never seen before. I wasn't ready. I'm watching Caitlin Clark in Prada. I'm seeing Cartier glasses. I'm a fashion nut, as you guys know. I love fashion. I'm seeing these ladies come across the stage like, oh, look at her.
So where do we take it from here?
I like that gown.
Get them paid.
Revenue share. Right now, the NBA revenue share, the men take 50%. Right now, the ladies take 20%.
Yikes.
Let's get that revenue share up.
Absolutely. That's a great way to apologize. Absolutely. That's a great way to apologize. Show them the money.
We are coming to the end of the show, which means it's time for Mickey Gomez. Good morning, Mickey.
Hey, good morning.
So you released a story this past week that's getting a lot of traction. According to a recent report, SeaTac Airport has seen a surge in car thefts over the past year. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so the numbers are up. It's a staggering 134% increase in auto theft. However, we spoke to Perry Cooper at the airport, and he's like, okay, everyone, just kind of calm down. They have approximately 2 million vehicles that go through the airport parking garage every year. So the annual, the percentage of stolen cars still remains quite low. 99.9% of the vehicles that park at SeaTac do end up going home to the rightful owner, right? What we're talking about is a very small number. They had about 173 stolen cars out of 2 million. So even though it's 134% increase, it's not as bad as, let's say, someplace like Dallas-Fort Worth,
right,
where they saw like over 900 cars stolen in a year. Yeah, I don't hear you. Are you on?
Yeah, sometimes. Oh, there you are. Sometimes there I like are. Making reactions off. Mm-hmm.
He said, "Wow, by the way,
was that what he said? Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's I mean, what, but so I had to ask. You know, all right, Perry, why are we seeing an increase in cars being stolen? And not to victim shame, he said, I just want to preface this: people are leaving their cars unlocked. Either they're in a hurry. You know, and the thieves are, you know, coming around, and what they do is they walk the garage and they're just trying to open up doors.
But the airport is locked down like Fort Knox most of the time. Yeah. How do they not have more security patrolling the parking garage?
He says they do have a lot of security. According to him, there is security.
There's an increase in car thefts.
There is an increase. Another thing is that not only are thieves looking for unlocked doors, they're finding key fobs. Mm-hmm. People are leaving their key fobs in their car. So it's easier for someone, 2 seconds, ooh, unlocked door, key fob right there in the tray, car is on, and then they're going through.
Has anyone here had their car either stolen or broken into at SeaTac?
Broken, not at SeaTac. But
no,
I've had
not
it
at SeaTac,
into.
But I've had my car broken into.
Yeah, I think I'll probably have
I think everyone can do that. Yeah. Why do you ask that question? Yeah. I want to know.
Well, I'm just kind of curious that if it is, in fact, a problem with crime in the garage. I mean, and as you're saying, it's a pretty low percentage. Even though it's up, it's not up a whole lot as far as car theft goes. But car theft sometimes turns into just a car break-in. They can't get the car going. They frequently will still ransack it, get some stuff, and get out. I mean, sometimes those are closely associated, at least from what I understand from police.
Yeah, Perry Cooper says, please do not leave anything of valuable in your car. It makes you a target, even down to the little bit of change that some of us always keep in our car, like quarters, dimes, nickels, pennies. Like, that's what thieves are looking for, and they're going to try, and if it's in there, they're going to try and get it.
You're supposed to just keep that center console open, your glove box open, just to show
that
it's empty.
That it's
empty? So there's no temptation.
I've never heard of that before, but
no?
Maybe...
I got my car broken into, that was one of the pieces of advice from police. And number two was to not put your... You know how they always... It used to be that you keep your registration in the glove box. You're not supposed to do that.
No, you're really
because
not.
So much information is on there, including where you live,
that's
if you have a garage door opener.
Why they break in is to get that registration. I don't know why that's not something we can have in our phone. You know, it would make so much more sense than having it in your car.
You can keep your registration in your phone. I did a story a year and a half ago that the SPD in Washington will allow you to take a picture of your car's registration. And so when you do get pulled over and they're like, license and registration, you can actually show your registration on your phone.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense. That makes a lot more sense.
I'd love to hear that.
So one more question about this then. So if... The advice is obviously, and to your point about leaving your car unlocked or leaving the glove, I used to do when I drove a convertible, aggro convertible Fiat. And so actually it getting stolen would have been a huge benefit, generally speaking. But given that I did have to drive it, I always would leave if it was covered, I'd leave the top down because otherwise they're just going to cut the top. You know, that's another $1,200 damage. So to your point, I would just leave everything wide open. Is that what they recommend, is to just not to leave your car? I mean, what about leaving your car, you know, with the glove box open or something along those lines.
We didn't talk about any of that. I mean, he just said, take everything. Like, you know, if you're going to the airport, even if you're going to the airport to pick somebody up and you want to meet them by baggage claim, and let's say you've got Target bags because you just went to Target or Walmart or some store.
Don't leave them in your,
because as quick as you leave and come back, that's how quickly your car can be ransacked or stolen. Another thing he did say is that, listen, when you go through the gates, the garage at the airport, you are on camera. That should be a big deterrent for thieves. I don't know why it's not, but he said there are cameras all over the place. It helps Port Police find your vehicle, hopefully, rather than not.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.